Welcome to Narratology. Each episode will offer unique insights and perspectives from people countering the narrative. We seek to tell stories that bring a critical lens to the events shaping our present and our past. We will bring activists, artists, influencers, advocates, and innovators to you, and together engage in powerful discussions. I'm your host, Charles Stevens. Welcome to Narratology. Our guest today is Dan Royals, who has a new book out, To Make the Wounded Whole, The African-American Struggle Against HIV and AIDS. Dan, why don't you tell us about yourself?
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Dan Royals. I am an assistant professor of history at Florida International University in Miami, where I teach courses on African-American history, contemporary United States history, LGBT history, oral history, a whole bunch of stuff. And I've been there since 2015. I got my doctorate in history from Temple University in 2014. And I wrote my dissertation on the same topic. That dissertation is now a book out with University of North Carolina Press, To Make the Wounded Whole. And I'm really, really happy to be here. Really happy to be talking to you, Charles, about that work.
Awesome. I know I've been following your work for years. I've been impressed with your engagement of community and just how you have used your platform as a scholar and as an academic to really elevate and amplify the stories of perhaps people that are not always very well known in the broader HIV movement history, which kind of gets me to my next question, which is, what inspired you to write, you know, this amazing book, To Make the Wounded Whole? What was your journey like to, you said you started with your dissertation, but like, what was that journey like?
So this project really started back in 2009. I was in graduate seminar at Temple. The topic was social movements. I think it was social movements in the 1960s and 70s. And I was like, but can I do the 80s and 90s too? And so I had to write a research paper for the seminar, and I wanted to write about AIDS in Philadelphia. And, you know, kind of irrespective of race or anything else, my idea was just like AIDS in Philadelphia. So I, you know, got into the archive and started looking at some different stories. And one of the stories that really stood out to me was the story of Babashi, the Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues, and the woman who helped to found it, a woman named Rashida Hassan. Today she's Rashida Abdul Kabir, but then she was Rashida Hassan. And Rashida is a Black Muslim nurse who grew up in Philadelphia. She didn't grow up Muslim. She grew up in a Christian church and converted later in life. But she was an infectious disease nurse working at Einstein Medical Center in the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia in the 1980s. And, you know, she is, again, she's Muslim. She wears a headscarf. I think it's called a niqab. And what was interesting to me about this was like the kind of vague idea I had about what AIDS activism was is very much informed by ACT UP and images of ACT UP, which are images predominantly of white gay men, mostly young white gay men, or, you know, kind of maybe early middle-aged white gay men. And here's a story that I found of this woman who, you know, started one of the first Black AIDS service organizations in the country. This is in 1985. And she, you know, looked different from the even unconscious mental image that I had of what an AIDS activist looks like. So right away, it kind of exploded what I had as, you know, kind of unexamined ideas about the story of AIDS activism in Philadelphia and in the country more broadly. And the story of Babashi is not only interesting because it was, you know, one of the first Black AIDS service organizations in the country, but because it was really born out of this fight at the local level in Philadelphia between Black gay men and their allies like Rashida, who were pushing the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force and a group called Philadelphia Community Health Alternatives, which were, you know, institutions that were rooted in the Philadelphia gay community, which was in many ways a segregated white gay community. And so because those institutions came out of that community, they were not good at reaching Black gay men, not even to mention, you know, Black MSM, Black great women, other people who were, you know, vulnerable and who were starting to really show up in the epidemiological reports. And so, you know, there was this really kind of intense local battle over these key issues of identity and community in the epidemic in a way that, you know, was really interesting to me. And also I did not see reflected in the stories that we had at that time about AIDS and AIDS activism in this country. And so that became really the kernel for the whole project. And I thought, you know, well, here's the story that just happened upon, you know, as a like second year grad student doing research. There are probably lots of other stories in other parts of the country that are similar. And sure enough, there were. And so, you know, that story of Babasha became the kernel for the dissertation. It's the first chapter in the book. And so that's really where it started, was just that one story that grabbed my attention in the archive, you know, and grew from there.
Yes. And certainly, you know, the story you tell about Rashida and about Babashi was just really incredible. Another figure that appears in the book that you talk about pretty extensively is Reggie Williams. Could you tell our listeners about Reggie Williams and the National Task Force on AIDS Prevention?
Yeah. Reggie Williams was the head of a group called the National Task Force on AIDS Prevention, which grew out of another organization, the National Association of Black and White Men Together. Reggie Williams grew up in Ohio, I believe it's Cincinnati, and you know, moved to California in the 70s, ended up in San Francisco with his partner, Bell, who was white, Reggie was black, in San Francisco in the early 1980s, you know, right as AIDS hit, or right as we began to recognize the disease that would become known as AIDS. And Reggie was an x-ray technician at UCSF Hospital. And so, you know, he was seeing people come into the hospital at the same time that he and Tim Isbell were seeing their friends start to get sick and die. And they were involved in a group called Black and White Men Together, the San Francisco chapter of Black and White Men Together, which was a national organization, a kind of loose confederation of local chapters. And in a kind of similar way to the story of Babashi, they took a look at what was going on in terms of outreach and education, epidemiology in San Francisco, in places like the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, at San Francisco General Hospital, at Shanti, which is the AIDS housing group, and started to kind of collect stories about people who, you know, Black and Latino men who were treated unfairly or, you know, in a discriminatory fashion in any of these places, along with, you know, the failure of some groups like San Francisco AIDS Foundation to step outside of the communities that they grew out of, which were, again, largely segregated white gay communities. You know, I think some of the men who started groups like San Francisco AIDS Foundation, like, didn't realize how inhospitable their communities were to gay men of color. And so, you know, Reggie and others in Black and White Men Together San Francisco, you know, started to point and call those things out. And Reggie got linked up with some other, you know, men from around the country by the late 1980s through the National Association of Black and White Men Together. And they put together a proposal for the Centers for Disease Control to get some major funding to start a national organization, the National Task Force on AIDS Prevention. So I think it's the first time that a group of gay men of color, a group that is avowedly for gay men of color, got federal funding. I'm almost certain that this is the case. If there are other cases that I'm unaware of, you know, I hope folks will let me know. But, you know, they got something like, you know, $200,000, which sounds like a lot of money, even in 1988, was not, you know, kind of enough money to do work over 5 years, designing, implementing AIDS education and outreach programs for gay men of color. And so one of the things that's interesting about Reggie and the work that the National Task Force did is that they created kind of coalitions of groups in San Francisco and elsewhere of Black gay men's groups, Latino gay men's groups, Asian American gay men's groups, American Indian gay men's groups, and really organized around this idea that there is a category of gay men of color that have a lot to stand to benefit really from working together to go after major funding, but also to share resources, to create spaces for them to have community together at the same time that they are, you know, in each of those communities, really designing targeted, culturally competent, culturally specific programs for Black gay men and for Latino gay men and for Asian American gay men and for American Indian gay men.
Your use of gay men of color is intentional here for our listeners in the sense that Reggie, though a Black gay man, was intentional about creating this coalition space with other gay men of color. And in the book, you have this really interesting analysis about how Black gay men specifically located themselves or connected to other kinds of configurations. So how Black gay men showed up in the Bobashi space in Philadelphia versus what was happening in the Bay Area with National Task Force, with like Reggie's model of a more like gay men of color model versus New York, which takes us to the next question I want to ask about, which is GMAD and Charles Angel. But the sort of GMAD model where Black gay identity was seen as more integrated and ultimately, I think, sort of echoed and amplified and prefigured how Black gay subjectivity was articulated and projected by Joseph Beam, Marlon Riggs, Essex, and Phil, and those folks. I was just wondering if you could talk a bit about GMAD, how GMAD fits into this movement history, and Charles Angel, and just what our listeners should know about what was happening in New York.
Yeah, and you really said it well, and that's that we have these kind of different models of how Black gay men are thinking at the time about their identity with respect to larger configurations of Blackness, larger configurations of gayness, larger configurations of third world or global South identity in some cases. And so what we see in GMAD, you know, kind of in contrast to what we see in the National Task Force, is really an articulation of a holistic Black gay identity that sees those as, you know, kind of mutually constitutive parts of a single whole. And so, you know, what we see in Gay Men of African Descent, I think, is a lot more focus on looking to examples of Black identity, either in the African American past. So look, you know, looking to the Harlem Renaissance, looking to Bayard Rustin, or to, you know, kind of African tradition, African history, the idea of the model of Adoti, you know, kind of Black gay elders in the Yoruba tradition. You know, they're really looking to those touch points to not only inform the kinds of programs that they design for Black gay men around AIDS, but to claim a space within Black identity for the sense of Black gayness. Because at the time, you know, the folks that they're in conversation with are like Malefi Asante, Frances Cress Welsing, who are, you know, arguing that there is no space for Blackness, no space within Blackness for gayness or for, you know, men to love other men in the way that they do. So one of the kind of core objectives of the book is to show that there are, A, like there is a thing that is Black AIDS activism that exists in, and it has existed in this country because not enough people know that to be the case, but also this wasn't a really creative, diverse project where you have, you know, models of outreach and education and identity and community that really look different from each other. And that's not to say that, you know, the National Task Force and Bobashi and GMAD, like that they have nothing in common with each other. That's not the case. But they do have these key differences that really speaks to the vitality of this as a movement. And one of the things that stuck out to me in doing the research is, you know, obviously these folks are really aware of each other. Like Reggie Williams and Rashida Hassan were friends. They became friends through doing this work.
And we also see Joseph Beam, who's in Philadelphia, obviously being, I imagine, in some ways in conversation with what was happening in New York. So, you know, the geography isn't, I mean, you know, obviously Pomo Afro Homos, which I think was based in the Bay Area, I think some of their model of identity politics might look more like GMAD than National Task Force on AIDS Prevention. it's also interesting just that certainly there were certain sensibilities within organizations and institutions, but they also weren't limited to just geography or to institutions, that there were sensibilities that flourished throughout. And I imagine that those lines weren't always very neat. As you said, Reggie, you know, there's like an amazing picture of him and Marlon Riggs together. And this is just in the US context, let alone what was happening in London in the UK. But yeah, it's just fascinating how people were trying to make sense of all of these interesting, complicated things to unravel.
Yeah. One story that I don't think found its way into the book that I may write about in the future, I'm not sure. Certainly, I hope that somebody will, is the story of Simon Nicoli from South Africa, who was jailed as an anti-apartheid protester in the 80s, you know, released. He was gay. He was HIV positive and became, you know, a Black gay AIDS activist in South Africa. You know, he traveled through the United States around all the BWMT chapters, you know, was like celebrated by the National Task Force, by GMAT, and made connections with those men. You know, we're talking like in the late 80s, early 90s. So there is this engagement with, as you said, not only the UK, but also activists in South Africa and in other places. There is this kind of, you know, sense of global identity or a global network for Black gay men, you know, that is coming into being.
If you look at, like, so you have a film, Isaac Julian's film, Looking for Langston, where he's obviously invoking Langston Hughes as a sort of like symbolic figure in the film. So he's in conversation and, you know, Essex Hemphill spent time in the UK and, you know, there's Tongues Untied, the Marlon Riggs film, but there's an anthology called Tongues Untied that came out in the UK before Tongues Untied. So there really is an interesting conversation that's happening across the Atlantic. And speaking of future book projects, I would love for someone to write about just that sort of Black gay Atlantic sort of conversation, or even like the broader diasporic conversation that you were sharing with South Africa and so forth. So I'm so glad you brought that up. I did want to ask, and I certainly have to ask, and I'm sure you've gotten the question before, and I think you probably know where I'm going, is just that, like, what does it mean to be a white scholar telling these kinds of stories and engaging this kind of work? Like, what has the response been? And just how have you sort of navigated being white and certainly writing a book about Black HIV movement history? What are some of the ways that you've sort of, you know, negotiated that in the context of power and privilege, certainly, in telling these stories?
You're absolutely right. That's a question that I've thought a lot about and have gotten before and, you know, and have had a lot of opportunity to kind of sit with. And I think that one of the things that really helped in this process was that I did so much oral history as part of the research. And I contend that there is something about oral history that is really special and unique in that you are sitting with somebody in silence, listening to your story in a way that I find to be humbling and in a way that I hope, I hope, you know, kind of mitigates some of the embedded power relationship that is there for me as a white scholar writing Black history. You know, it is there, no denying that. But I think there's something really powerful about sitting and listening more or less in silence, because if you do oral history right, and certainly the way that I tried to do oral history is for me to do very little talking and for the other person to do a whole lot of talking, you know, it really is about building empathy with other people's experience. And it's more powerful in some ways than, you know, being in the archive and reading documents, which also is very important and powerful. But I think something about, you know, being physically with somebody and listening to their story. And then you used a word that I really like, which is amplifying that story, which is something that I hope that the project does. The oral histories kind of also live as a separate but overlapping project with the book. And those will be archived. Some are already available online. You know, but the idea there is like, not just that I've done research and written a book that tells these stories, but that it's laying the ground for other stories to be told. Not all the interviews made it into the book. You know, I hope that in that way, I have helped to build an archive for a set of stories that we don't have enough resources for right now, or have not had.
One of my favorite chapters in a book was when you write about Dazon Dixon Diallo and Sister Love. And, you know, Dazon's certainly someone that has been such an inspiration to me and someone that also lives in my city, Atlanta. And could tell our listeners about Dazon, about Sister Love, and just what they should know about her, her legacy.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you like that chapter because I think it's one of my favorites too. It was the last one that I wrote. And, you know, it didn't get added actually until pretty late in the process. We hosted a symposium on AIDS and philanthropy at the Rockefeller Archive Center outside New York in 2017. And Dazon was one of the folks that we invited to take part as somebody who had been an AIDS activist and AIDS advocate for a long time. So she started this group, Sister Love. I think they actually started in the early 90s, you know, but has been a part of the reproductive justice movement since the 1980s and, you know, has been in that movement with people like Loretta Ross and Billy Avery, who are all other kind of like stalwarts, you know, key shining lights of that movement. And, you know, what Dazon really brought to the work was looking at AIDS in Black women, you know, holistically within the picture of reproductive justice, you know, women's access to the tools to, you know, have control over the reproductive health and over their bodies, the kind of larger story of the fight for bodily autonomy among Black women in the United States. And so, you know, she has been in this fight for 30 years now. And in something of a similar way to the work that Reggie did, you know, part of that work has been creating spaces for community and for resource sharing with other women of color organizations. So again, Latina groups, Asian American groups, Native American groups, and other Black women's reproductive justice groups as well. And, you know, it was really kind of having the opportunity again to sit with her at the symposium and listen to her tell, again, some pretty hard truths about what it has been like for her to be a Black woman advocating for Black women in spaces and institutions that liberal or progressive, but are nonetheless, you know, tacitly white, normatively white, you know, or kind of, you know, just dominant culture in that way. And so it was out of those conversations that it became clear to me that this was a story that really needed to be in the book. And so, you know, I'm very grateful to her, not only for the work that she's done, but what she did to teach me and to teach us in our conversations with her about, you know, some of the realities that she faced. I think some themes in the book came to the fore through the conversations that we had, particularly the ones about funding, you know, which is a kind of story that I was seeing in the sources, but, you know, it's part of the story of like what happened to Bibashi and what happened to National Task Force is also part of what happened to Sister Love. And it's these grassroots groups emerged to address a public health crisis and were able to get some money, but never enough money and never with the support that they needed to, you know, satisfy the litany of requirements that grant makers attached to that money. That's something that I think we need kind of more research on, is like the political economy of AIDS advocacy and AIDS grant making that, you know, that I kind of had a sense of, but really came to the fore for me through conversations with Dazon.
Thank you for sharing that. And I guess for the final question, how can our listeners find out about you? How can they get in touch with you? I'm sure there are many, many questions folks have about you and your work. And how can they just learn more about you and what you're up to?
So, you know, listeners can email me at droyals@gmail.com. It's my first initial last name. I'm on Twitter at Dan Royals. You can visit a related project or a project that is related to the book, the African American AIDS History Project, which is the kind of digital archive piece of the research. So that has some of the oral histories. It has oral histories with Rashida, with Curtis Wadlington, who was an important part of Bibashi, with Rashida, who passed away in 2012, along with some papers that Curtis gave me to digitize when we did our interview, you know, back in 2012. So again, on the theme of trying to create or preserve a set of resources for people to continue to tell stories like this. You know, that is a project that, that folks can visit. The URL is afamaidshist.org. But if you search for African American AIDS History Project, that should come up. You know, I hope folks will check that out. It is a project that's set up to take contributions of sources. So, you know, if folks have kind of personal archives that they, you know, would like to see digitized or otherwise, you know, just find their way into institutions so people can continue to tell these kinds of stories, you know, I would be happy to talk with anybody about how that process works and, you know, connect them to folks that can help.
Dan Royals, to make the wounded whole, the African American struggle against HIV and AIDS. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Charles. And thank you for all the work that you're doing. I definitely see a lot of resonance between especially groups like GMAD, who are thinking so much about the picture of Black gay men's wholeness. You know, I see so much resonance between what they did and what you were doing. My hat is off to you, and thank you for all that you've done.